Hi there, welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. My guest this week is Christy van der Westhuizen. Christy is a professor of sociology at the University of Pretoria. She's the author of two books. Her first book, White Power, which focuses on the rise and fall of the National Party, was published in 2007. Her most recent offering, which was published late last year, is called Sitting Pretty, White Afrikaans Women in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Our discussion straddles some of the issues and the history covered in both of these books, among other things, of course. Christy grew up in Boksburg, outside Johannesburg, in what would be termed a lower middle-class household. And after finishing high school and then university, she worked as a reporter first for the anti-apartheid Afrikaans newspaper Vrye Weekblad, and then moved on to the more mainstream Beeld. It was after some time working in an international relations NGO that she then launched her academic career. We spoke about her childhood in Boksburg, her early questioning of the Afrikaner mainstream around her, and then some of the themes of race, power, and gender identity that form the backbone to the books I mentioned. We also chatted about issues around democratization, the re-emergence of a toxic Afrikaner nationalism, and the need to reboot the South African political discourse. Please enjoy now my chat with Christy. Christy, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, good to be with you, Nicholas.
And thank you for the books. You gave me two books. One is White Power. When did you write that?
That came out in 2007.
Okay, so that's an older book there, where you sort of track the fall more of the National Party, but you do go into sort of Afrikaner nationalism, and I want to touch a bit on that. And then your more recent book is Sitting Pretty, the sort of experience of Afrikaner women in a post-apartheid South Africa. So we'll sort of, I think, straddle two phases of our history, both pre and post-apartheid. The White Power begins in Boksburg, where you grew up. And can you just tell me a little bit about your upbringing, your family background? Did you have siblings?
Yes, I've got two sisters. I'm the eldest.
Okay.
And we grew up, basically my parents got divorced when I was in my early teens. So we grew up basically with a single mother. And in Boksburg, at the time of a very intense political contestation, also among, you had political contestation more broadly in the country, of course, among all South Africans, but also within the white group and within the Afrikaner group, you had very intense contestation with the Afrikaner Weerstandsbeweging, the Conservative Party,
HNP, Der Stichte
Nationale Partij, all of those geezers, and plus the National Party was ruling at the time, of course. And so we were actually in our classroom, we were divided according to these parties. It is very interesting to see how politicized, if I think back, how politicized we were as Afrikaner kids growing up in Boksburg.
Into those factions.
Yeah, so it was basically, I always say it was the NP kids, the CP kids, the AWB kids, and me, you know. So, and there was very much, so I was called a kaibuti, I was called a feminist. For them, a feminist is like, to call somebody a feminist is like a slur.
Ultimate insult.
You know, yeah. So so that was pretty much the, very intense arguments all the time. Mm. And,
How did you become that loner, come into that morass of fairly right-wing racist discourse, if you could call it that? How did you politicize yourself, or how come you were the only person aware, if I could put it that way, of what actually was going on in the country?
No, fortunately, I wasn't the only person. But, my theory is
that Afrikaners... Well, I'm speaking in that context.
Yes,
you were very much... I mean, you write that story of the birthday card, where everyone took an opportunity to wish you happy birthday and insult you, but at the same time.
And say that they thought I should be necklaced, as per the practice of the time. But basically, You know, my theory is that, you know, Afrikaners, almost from the moment that of the inception of official apartheid in 1948, you see a dissident starting to rise. And, you know, already in, you know, authors like Jan Rabie, Eis Kriege, and so on in the 1950s. And then from there, so it started in the arts, it started in literature, mm-hmm. and so forth. And then with later on with people like Ingrid Jonker, you know, André Brink, and so forth. Barbara Schneider as a theologian, of course, Bram Fischer. And then Breiten Breitenbach, again, on the literary side, but also in active politics. Mm. But anyway, so Afrikaners have always been it's a very politicized identity. And also in my family, people were staunch Afrikaner nationalists. So that's the tradition that I come from. Mm. And my mother herself, my grandmother was a member of the Osewa Brandwag, or Oxwagon Sentinel, which is basically like a proto-fascist
movement. I mean, people were interned during the Second World War for being fascist.
Yes, John Forster among them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's that was my gran, and then my mother also very political from a young age, and but different kind of politics to my grandmother in the sense that she believed that apartheid wasn't sustainable and that it should be reformed, but she believed from inside the National Party. Mm. She's an ordinary person, you know, who just was living her life, but very interested in politics and so forth, like the rest of her family, and adopting a more liberal position.
What did she do, your mum?
Then, in the early 80s, you know, to earn some bread for the household, she became a library assistant at Rapport newspaper.
Okay.
And that actually was a crucial moment, I think, just in the history of our family. In the sense that she then gained direct access. So by the time of your states of emergency, she would have access to the kind of information that you couldn't find in the newspapers at that stage, because journalists would be coming back.
She was talking to journalists.
Yeah, she was very good friends. Yeah, very good friends with the journalists who were covering the violence.
1985, then an extreme violent time for our
exactly.
country.
Exactly. So the state violence of the time and the details of which these journalists couldn't, because of the media restrictions, couldn't write about. And she was very good friends with a number of journalists. And at that time, I think that shifted her mind completely to the point where she realized that the there's no hope in the National Party itself, you know. Mm. So this kind of reformist thing of we're going to change things from within, there's absolutely no political hope for that. Mm. And then we also had an experience in terms of you know, a black woman was working for us at that time. As we know in South Africa, there's an army of domestic workers making whiteness possible at the household level, and she was taken off by the police one time for not having her passport on her, and that also so there were these sort of more personal, of course, we weren't affected in the way that she was, but it was an eye opener in terms of how she was mistreated by the police at the time, and then of course the other information that we were getting. So my mother was coming home and telling us about it, and so we were politicized, me and my sisters, from a young age, and actually conscientized very much. And at the same time, I was in terms of my gender identity, I was already quite non-conforming, and I was in terms of my sexual identity shifting in a different direction to what perhaps my mother would have wanted, and so that made me feel very out of place and at odds with my so-called community. And I had an identification as a budding young lesbian at that time. I had an identification with black people, with the plight of black people, because the people who were discriminating against me as a woman, and because of my emerging sort of sexual identity, they were also discriminatory towards black people. You know, so I saw a kind of a resonance in their racism, with the sexism and the homophobia that I was already starting to experience at that time. So that actually politicized me completely, and that's why I wanted to. My big thing was to become a political journalist then from a young age.
Yes, actually. which you did become because you joined the Freie Werkblatt, as I understand it. But I think then one thing I just want to touch on, and it's about the essay that you wrote at school, I forget what the actual topic was now, where you were kind of forbidden to ever write anything. It was kind of questioning Afrikaner identity and questioning the whole situation in the country at the time, which must have come as a real shock.
Yeah, the theme that we were given was Drome van Gister, which means dreams of yesterday. So I decided to write on apartheid.
Mm.
And my Afrikaans teacher almost had an apoplexy. You know, she was highly distressed. Juffrouw van Heerden.
Yeah,
she was extremely distressed, and she marked me down. And she wrote, "I'm marking you down, and if you do this again in the exams, I'm gonna, because this is an essay just as part of the ordinary
term work,
kind of And if you do this again in the exam, you are going to see it in your marks, basically.
And then we can maybe touch a little bit on the fray of it, but you ended up also at either one of the mainstream newspapers. Was it Beeld or Report that you then? You ended up at?
Vryweekblad closed down in beginning 1994.
Yeah.
And then I actually went on to translate the ANC's election manifesto for a while, and in the run-up to the election, and then also the first draft of the constitution. I was the Afrikaans translator on that. So which sort of happened through Vryweekblad,
Right, okay.
And then... And then that, of course, also ended, and I had to find another. Mm. I had to find a job, and that was so. That's how I landed up at Beeld, part of Nationale Pers, which, of course,
was part of the machine.
Yes.
But I'm trying to get to the story where again you were kind of scolded for writing something that didn't fit in with the editor's kind of view of the world. So I'm just wondering, was there always? Do you think there was always a recognition amongst the sort of Afrikaner powers that be, that the whole thing was that they kind of didn't have a belief in what they were essentially standing for, that they recognized the inherent weakness of the structure, and therefore it shouldn't really be spoken about in anything but glowing terms?
Well, as we know, there was a very strong authoritarian dimension to apartheid, and it is very much a top-down kind of way of thinking, a kind of imagining of a social imagining which is very much top down. So there is this idea that there are those people in the elite, the political elite, but specifically the political elite, but also their hangers on, in the church, the
business,
schools, education, and that they just know best, and that you should just fall in with them. So as an ordinary minion in the system, you need to just fall in because the leaders know best, and that's where that censorship of ideas and speech and so forth come from. But I think you are right that, of course, frequently it has to do with an anticipation of the ending of the system through dissidents, and one of the ways through which we demonstrate dissidents, of course, is through our speech. And that's why it's so important for the powers that be then in an authoritarian system like apartheid to clamp down on that. So very, very massive kinds of censorship interventions from the start, And so this whole thing of being questioning is completely frowned upon. You shouldn't be thinking for yourself. You shouldn't be questioning things because the leaders know better, and that was the attitude of that teacher as well.
Yeah.
And the one thing about my mother, who is always a bit of an odd one out in her own family, is that she taught me and my sisters from the start to be very questioning, to be curious about the world, to adopt a curious and critical disposition towards the world. And I'm extremely, it's a complete fluke, you don't know where you're going to land up when you get born. So I'm completely, I'm completely happy that that's how it actually panned out for me, because from the start it was really something that was encouraged in us to think twice, to look at something, askance and ask questions about it.
That's a good
and
gift,
I've always adopted, that's been my disposition. It's sometimes might be quite unpopular, but I feel it's a very necessary disposition.
Mm.
It's particularly in a democracy. In an authoritarian system, of course, people have to become questioning to overthrow the system. But in a democracy also, we need questioning citizens who think about things.
Yes. Could you tell me a little bit about your journey from working in the media to academia and how that shift took place?
Well, you mentioned earlier about I had a bit of a disagreement with my editor about a column. So I, after leaving Vrijweekblad and leaving the translation services, I went over to Beeld, where I sort of worked my way up from crime reporting to political, to become political correspondent, which is sort of the most
traditional
senior
kind of path, I suppose, yeah, for many, yeah, as you start, yeah, at the courts, don't you?
Yeah, but I was the first female senior political correspondent in Beeld's history in 1999 when I got the post. So, but I was writing already as an environmental reporter earlier on. I started writing columns because I was interested in analysis. So to get to the story behind the news, how do we make sense of the news? So analysis for me is very important. So I basically, I was writing environmental columns and then I shifted into politics. And at that time, it was actually, it's shortly after the 94 elections, so things were much more in flux. Also in terms of Beeld and Nationale Pers as a kind of a bastion of Afrikaner nationalist thinking previously.
Right.
So it was a rare historical opening, actually, in terms of how things were playing out, also in terms of speech, at these newspapers of Nationale Pers. And Beeld was really at the forefront of
trying to reassess its whole
role.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. And allowing us, actually, as reporters at the time, also political journalists, freedoms that weren't imaginable.
Even a couple of years previously.
Absolutely. So I wrote, then you see a kind of a closing again from the early 2000s, which probably is reflected in shifts in the Afrikaner community more generally, But and I wrote something on the Democratic Party of the time, because the National Party had basically lost most of its voters to the Democratic Party, and I thought that's a valid question here to ask: why on earth would these Afrikaner nationalists
go with this?
Go over to the party of English liberalism.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that column was pulled at the very last minute by the editor, and he said to me, "You shouldn't rile your readers. Your readers don't want to think about these things. You shouldn't." So I said to him, "No, I completely disagree with you. I see that my role as
exactly
not to rile them, but to ask questions that they may be wondering about.
And or give them some information.
I don't underestimate people. I believe that people are thinking." Whether they, whoever they are, whatever political position they hold, people do think about things, and as a journalist, absolutely, my role is to give them more material to work with when they're thinking through things, And we want an active citizenry. So how do you get that? Not by discouraging a critical questioning, So anyway, so after that, you can't be a columnist with a sword hanging over your head. So I resigned shortly after that to join the short-lived Nigerian paper, Nigerian-owned paper called This Day. People then called That Day after a while.
I was in the country at that time. Was that early 2000s?
That
then?
Was 2003 to 2004. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was deputy editorial page editor there, so which is great. So I was writing a column, but I was also in charge of, deputizing on the op-ed page and writing editorials. So that was really great.
Why did that paper fail?
We still sort of speculate about it, but there was an incredible expenditure of money, and then suddenly the money just dried up, we had a very, very fancy offices with fantastic new Mac computers in Sandton.
All the whistles and bells.
Yeah, and then suddenly, so incredible splash of capital being spent, and then the next minute it's all gone. Yeah, so but then at that point already, I was thinking. I had a certain frustration in me about news and the limitations of news. I did my master's degree at that time as well, looking at globalization and gender in the early 2000s because I was trying, as a news reporter, especially at the Daily, you're very much busy with the day-to-day. And you can lose that big picture very easily, you know. So for me, it was important and I wanted to allow myself to be in a position where I can spend more time thinking about things, thinking about that bigger picture and how it links to the smaller, the
analysis
the micro
that comes
stuff.
From that then as well.
Yeah.
So you did your master's and that sort of then planted the seed for your academic career then, would you say?
Well, at that point I wasn't, that was before I went to This Day, so I still, and then from This Day I actually moved, I worked at an international relations organization as a senior researcher. There I had, it's actually the first time that I had some direct experiences of sexism and homophobia, which you would have thought I would have experienced
gone,
it at Beeld.
Yeah.
But in Beeld, it was sort of interesting. I didn't actually experience a bit of sexism, no homophobia really. But at this organization, there was some direct sort of differential treatment, especially when my sexuality came to light.
Jeepers.
And so I left shortly after. I just wanted to publish one edited volume there, which I did, called Gender Instruments in Africa, which is just a bunch of research papers, really. And then I decided to write my first book, White Power and the Rise and Fall of the National Party. So I actually left them to go off and write White Power.
Quite ironic, given the topic of your research, that you would find your sexuality questioned in that kind of organization. But I suppose we never really know where that's coming from, because it can come from anywhere.
Well, I think in this case, international relations itself as a discipline is very conservative in my experience. And when I arrived, I said, well, my master's is on globalization and gender, so I want to take that further in my research. And I was told by the director, African leaders, they don't really like this gender stuff. So you should rather not. What's this now with women and all of that weird kind of, those kinds of weird things? No. I said, well, that's my area of specialization, and that's what I want to do my research on. And I was very adamant. Mm. And that's why in the end I thought, well, I'm going to show you that you can actually do very solid research in international relations on gender. And that's why I brought out that edited volume, Gender Instruments in Africa. So to make exactly that point. And then it's quite ironic, then after when I left, I actually appointed another woman who's also a specialist in gender, and who she brought out a volume two of Gender Instruments in Africa. Yeah, so I made my point, basically. But I thought, I've got things to do, and that's why I decided to move on and write White Power.
That kind of took me back, I have to say, reading about, I haven't read the whole book, but, just some of the early chapters looking at the emergence of Afrikaner nationalism sort of in the post-South African War, Boer War, however we want to call that, and as a sort of, I'm not sure if it's, well, I'd be interested to see what you say, if it was a reaction to colonialism or a development of colonialism, because we shouldn't sort of hide the fact that racism, segregation, and all of those structures were very much in place before the National Party came to power in 1948 and were very much part of the South African political structure from the arrival of white people in the country. So how do you see the relationship between Afrikaner nationalism and British colonialism, particularly sort of in that period?
Well, this region, the southernmost point of Africa, has had the grave misfortune of not having one settler class, but two settler classes, arriving on its shores. So, and what that means is that you actually had a competition that, of course, developed with the arrival of the second settler class, the British, in the 19th century. And your South African War, which, I prefer to call the South African War because it didn't only involve British and Boer people. It was actually everybody living in South Africa at the time. It's actually before South Africa as a country, of course, existed. But in this region, everybody was impacted by that war, and some people, some black people, also in atrocious ways. As we know, there were black concentration camps where as many black people died. So what happens with that South African war is that even, you know, while the British won the war with great effort, of course, in the end, they had something like a quarter of a million soldiers.
I mean, it was probably the first global war. I mean, there were soldiers from all over the empire fighting here, and then there were Irish nationalists fighting against the British for the Boers and all kinds. I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah. And then what you have straight after that is you know, the British thinking that they now can anglicize this other settler class that they've now vanquished or believe that they had vanquished, and that you know, the humiliation of the war, the atrocities of the war, you know, with 24,000 plus minus women and children dying in the concentration camps. The, you know, men who landed up at St. Helena in terrible conditions, et cetera, et cetera. All of that served to create or to politicize this particular group of settlers. And then, and that's where, so I mean, there were stirrings of a kind of a proto-nationalism in the late 19th century in the Cape Colony. But you see, after the war and with the humiliations of the humiliations of the war, with the atrocities, the deaths. We had people die. I mean, in our own family, there are people who died in the camps, and so forth. So most Afrikaners affected in some way or another, and that's of course politicized people. So you have an incredible cultural, political, and economic and social movement that is sort of spurred on in reaction against British imperialism. So Afrikaner nationalism is basically a nationalism in reaction to British imperialism. And if you think of the National Party that started in 1914, the ANC started in 1912. So African nationalism is also in reaction to British imperialism. Mm. And as I argue in White Power, British imperialism can be seen as a nationalism writ large, you know, a nationalism projected onto the global stage. So both of these nationalisms, African and Afrikaner, were in a sense instigated by the effects of British imperialism. But then, sadly, for absolutely everybody who's ever been in this region, Afrikaner nationalists wanted to. Well, they were very much in the crucible of that moment, where you had a particular kind of colonial whiteness that was emerging. You know, and that these are the years of eugenics. You know, and
master race.
Yeah, all of that
folk.
Blood purity. Thinking, which of course we know that doesn't exist, so-called racial purity, which doesn't exist, all of that. So those were the years, and those were the kinds of influences that you then see being taken up in Afrikaner nationalism. Mm. And instead of finding common cause with the other people who are oppressed in the same region by British imperialism, they decided to go on their own. And so there's a kind of a competition situation in between these two settler classes. And that's why Afrikaner identity, it's the use of ethnicity actually to set themselves apart from the British so that they can mobilize people in support of their political project. And then finally they gain power in 48. And apartheid is an elaboration of the colonial system from before, but it's basically a modernization of it. Because if you think this is, of course, one of those ironies. 48 is also the year when the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights was adopted.
Yeah.
So the rest of the world, because of these very fierce anti-colonial struggles, the colonial powers were withdrawing actually from colonies and giving up on them and being forced in those decades to give up on the so-called colonial properties and yeah. so forth. And the Afrikaners went exactly in the mm. other direction by re-entrenching and actually modernizing colonial power, you know, in South Africa.
Mm.
So in my book, in Sitting Pretty, I actually write about this competition between the two settler classes and then what that creates, because there's a kind of just about whiteness kind of character, just about white character to Afrikaner identity, in the sense that when the British arrived here, if you look at the writings of European travellers and so on to this region, writing about the Dutch Boers.
Oh, the Boers as a sort of lower...
As a kind of a lower class.
Yeah.
They were called what, degraded colonists.
Yeah.
They're not keeping
not seen
up.
As quite white
enough. Yeah, yeah. And if you look at some of the British discourses of the time also, you know, calling Paul Kruger, you know, dirty and calling the Boers. But savages with a thin white veneer and so forth. So they weren't quite white enough. And then, so what happens then is like there's, Afrikaner nationalism can actually be seen as an ideology of whitening. So you have the big tragedy actually of people then being split off, families being split in half and so forth, as people who were then, in terms of phenotype, not seen as white.
Classified.
Being rejected.
Reclassified.
Yeah, but even before that,
uh-huh.
you have this kind of rejection and expulsion actually of people of color from Afrikaner ranks. And then you see this whitening of the Afrikaner identity. So that, I mean, as a Van der Westhuis, and half of the Van der Westhuis in South Africa are black or brown, as an Afrikaans we would say bruin.
Mm.
And, you know, none of them are in my direct family, you know. So, and that's that massive splitting, something that we still have to deal with, actually, as Afrikaners today.
Mm. I mean, I suppose what you're confronting in Sitting Pretty is the post-apartheid experience of the Afrikaner, but particularly the Afrikaner woman. And I just wanted to ask you to sort of, if you could, because it's obviously quite a complicated topic, how would you distill that experience? Do you feel that Afrikaners in post-apartheid South Africa have missed an opportunity to kind of develop a new identity?
Well, not all Afrikaners. I think some Afrikaners. And I think the identity has become much more complex in the post-apartheid era, just to the extent that, as I found in my book and my research, that a lot of white Afrikaans-speaking people don't identify anymore as Afrikaners. So they're even rejecting the identity of Afrikaner. Some of them do it because they actually want to try and get rid of the stigma of apartheid. So as there was earlier the stigma about not being completely white enough, you know, there's in the post-apartheid era, there's the stigma of being the architects, the supporters, the drivers of the system of apartheid, which, as we know, in the end, provoked global opprobrium. You know, so there's a post-apartheid sort of efforts at rehabilitating the identity, and some people do it by saying, "I'm not an Afrikaner," and in that way, they're trying to distance themselves from apartheid. You know, then you get those people who say, "I'm not an Afrikaner because I can't actually, Afrikaner identity is so embedded in apartheid. It's so part of apartheid, and apartheid is so part of Afrikaner identity that for me, I feel to be a fully active democratic citizen. I need to leave that identity behind and do something else." So these are people who really want to participate fully as South Africans. They also identify in the first place as South Africans.
In the Democratic Project.
Yeah, and they're white Afrikaans speakers, but they specifically identify with the Democratic Project, and they're trying to work wherever they are to advance it. But then, so you get all these contradictions. Then you get those people who still identify as Afrikaners and do it because they think apartheid was a good thing.
Mm.
And they can't understand, you know, people What's are being that? Unrealistic, you know. Yeah. These are like, I mean, you're really your diehard racists who can't let go of the terrible prejudices.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you have those people who identify as Afrikaners who say, well, I to the irritation of many of many Afrikaners, I do identify as an Afrikaner because I want to show that you can, that there can be diversity in this identity. Mm. And it's very important to because there's no, there isn't really a tradition of, you know, apart from these few people, Bram Fischer, Beyers Nadir, Ingrid Jonker, and so forth, you know, Marie de Toy, who was a trade unionist, and so forth, a few people, there isn't really a tradition of dissidents, of alternative out. Thinking. Mm. Yeah. And so it's important,
the
I think...
The full Freya movement or the Freya Werkblatt in our time. That,
yeah. Oh, and then, of course, the Garment Workers Union, who was one of my favourite historical phenomena, these socialist Volksmoeders, you know, mothers of the nation. Mm. So you had these moments in time, and those few moments, I think one should gather and remind Afrikaners and white Afrikaans speakers
that it's not so monolithic.
Yeah, there's a different way of being, and we can actually be active citizens in our democracy and advance democracy and also advance justice and advance the human dignity of everybody living here.
Mm. One of the things that struck me, I was reading an article, is that also the idea of Afrikaners, well, it was particularly women that you were talking to, who prefer to speak English as a way also of kind of separating themselves from their Afrikanerness. So that's coming out of that what you're talking about, that same sort of...
Well, there is that idea of sort of elevating yourself by speaking English and it shows you that there's a sort of Willem de Klerk, who's an old sort of reformist Afrikaner nationalist.
T.F.W. de Klerk's brother, wasn't he?
He coined the concepts verlichte and verkrampte.
Yeah, right.
But he was actually speaking at the time of an inferiority complex, a collective inferiority complex that Afrikaners suffer from, and that was in the early 80s when he was writing about that. So that's more than 80 years after the war, and you still have that. So
you still have the remnants of that now.
Yeah. And but it's interesting, of course, these kinds of wounds that most nations, nationalism actually thrives on finding these collective hurts, these collective wounds that nationalism then keeps alive in a very particular kind of way to mobilize people. Mm. So that's how I understand that. But it's not. I do think that there's a lot of value in making more sense of the historical traumas that Afrikaners have suffered. To understand why we got apartheid, and then to understand as Afrikaners what we can do now, because in a sense there wasn't a full reckoning with all of these different elements, and then you had the worst kind of outcome, where people who were wronged in the most atrocious way, then went on to wrong other people in the most atrocious, in an even more atrocious way. Mm. You know,
it's kind of like sometimes how I feel about Israel and the Palestinians, sometimes, that sort of reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was, I read somewhere, maybe I'm just kind of making this up, but I'm interested, what sort of came to me, that identity is used often as a tool of power, but I think it was you who was saying it can also be a shackle, because it kind of just... It forces you into a way of behavior and thinking that becomes almost counterproductive. Is that a correct analysis?
Well, if you overly identify with a particular ideology, you know, or a particular stance, you know, then I do think it does become more like a prison, and that's why just intellectually. You know, they have been, if you think about, something like queer theory and so forth, you know, there have been a lot of thinking towards how can we get beyond these restrictive identities that also set us up against one another in the most terrible ways. So over-identification with the white position, you know, with the patriarchal position, with heteronormativity and so forth, that ultimately, of course, you know, people also do it because they gain incredible power out of it. You know, so you create, you adhere to exactly those ideologies of racism, sexism, homophobia, and so forth, because you want to create these hierarchies that will actually install you above other people.
Maintain that power relation. Yeah.
So I wanted to look at Afrikaner women specifically to see how they navigate this contradictory position, and I specifically looked at heterosexual middle class white Afrikaans-speaking women. So it means that they're finding themselves at this intersection of, on the one hand, occupying the gendered position, which is an inferiorized position, that of being a woman, and but on the other hand, enjoying, you know, the privileges of whiteness, of middle classness, of heteronormativity.
Mm.
And so Sitting Pretty, the title actually refers to that double kind of position that they hold. On the one hand, they are enjoying the position of white privilege still in post-apartheid South Africa. In fact, white people are even better off, yeah, wealth-wise. But these women are still finding themselves very much ensnared by
the patriarchy.
Yeah, by the strictures of a particular form of ethno-racial heteropatriarchy. And it was interesting to see, for example, women who dare to enter into interracial relationships, it frequently means the end of your relationship with your family.
Hmm.
You know, so you have to make a choice.
Yeah.
Women who may be attached to I'm talking about heterosexual women now. So a woman who's attached to a white Afrikaans-speaking man, and for some reason they can't reproduce, and South Africa. As we know, I mean, when you adopt, you will be adopting a black child, because there's an incredible need, of course, as well. So many of the respondents in my study talking about how that it's an absolute no-no. It's the end, yet again, of your family with your relationship with your family. You will basically be expelled.
Mm-hmm.
So that means, and that is almost like
the
oldest.
And that's happening now.
Yes, and post-apartheid. Not all women, of course.
No, sure.
So you have those women who adopt a dissident position and say, no, I am going ahead with this. And saying to the dad, no, to her dad, no, I'm not. If this means the end of our relationship, then that's
that,
it. And then it is the end of the relationship. You know. And think about it, that's the oldest trope, because if you look at Afrikaner identity, you know, we obviously emphasize race a lot when we analyze colonialism and apartheid. But colonialism and apartheid were both constituted actually through the abuse of all these differences. So how do you keep the so-called white race so-called pure? You police the sexual boundaries.
Mm.
And that means policing women's bodies. So that's about compulsory heterosexuality. And it's about a compulsory white heterosexuality.
Well, we had the Immorality Act, I suppose, was the example of that.
Mixed Marriages Act.
Mixed Marriages
Act. Those laws were passed right just when the National Party came to power in 1948. They were passed in 1949. So it shows you the kind of sexual panic that was actually in the Afrikaner nationalist elite about the possibility of losing so-called good Afrikaner women to black men.
Mm.
You know, so that kind of consternation about that possibility.
And that whole racial purity as well, coupled with that as well, I suppose. I just want to talk a little bit further about Sitting Pretty. You use two words. One of them is ordentlichkeit, and the other is Volksmoeder, which is my Afrikaans is terrible. Did I pronounce that correctly?
No, that's perfect. That's story.
if you could, ordentlichkeit in English means like proper, and then Volksmoeder is the mother of the people. Could you just maybe expand a little bit about why you used those two terms and how they helped you in your analysis of the sort of post-apartheid Afrikaner woman experience?
Yeah. Well, ordentlichkeit, I approach it through the lens of respectability. But as you say, it's actually one of those words that there's not a single English word for it. It refers to decency, being well-mannered. It's also a certain kind of physical comportment, actually how you carry your body in a particular kind of way. And I was trying to get hold of this sort of evasive part of Afrikaner identity, and to get to this, also to this question of not being or just being white, and therefore feeling a sense of shame of not accomplishing a certain standard of whiteness in the early 20th century. And then later on, after apartheid, of course, feeling yet again that you're again not respectable because you are the architect and the supporter of this abominable system called apartheid. So in a sense, what the post-apartheid Afrikaner identity is about recuperating respectability, to try and sort of
come back from position. The shame of,
yes, absolutely, to rejuvenate the identity as again as a moral identity, as a good identity. You know, as human beings, that's a basic desire that we have, is to be acknowledged as good and as decent human beings. And the Afrikaners, who, if you think about it, history was completely on their side after the South African War, and you know, the global sentiment was on their side. And they managed to completely reverse that and turn themselves into, well, as they refer also to that expression of being with the skunk of the world, and being very much affected by that. And now post-apartheid, there's a kind of attempt to recuperate themselves. But part of the problem is, of course, with the ANC government not faring as well as one would have hoped for, and given various problems that we have, including state capture, corruption, and more generalized corruption, and so forth, there's a kind of a schadenfreude that you now get with Afrikaners. And that's why the Afrikaner, not for all Afrikaners, but that's why there's a kind of a resurgence in a particular kind of intransigent, arrogant kind of whiteness, because it's kind of a "we told you so" kind of position that's adopted. And as I always say, I'm frequently on the Afrikaans radio and sort of engage with people, we're all in the same boat here. So if the boat sinks, we're sinking with it. So I can't quite understand this position of schadenfreude, you know, laughing at the black, the black government can't make it. Not that that's, you know, for me, it's not a black government. It's a democratically elected government. And we all, but it's also not only up to the government to try and salvage a country after 350 plus years of segregation and apartheid and colonialism, you know. So there's this, unfortunately, this identity is on the rebound, and it's actually in certain respects even worse. And now with the rise of a Trump and with Brexit and those far-right nationalists in Europe, this identity is getting, I'm talking about far-right Afrikaners, they're getting a sort of also a global injection, one could say.
Well, the AFRI Forum, I suppose, would fit into that quite well. I mean, you see, they went and visited, I think it was Washington, sort of pleading for, I don't know what they think they're pleading for there. But, it's quite a I feel like the world now is in a very, I mean, I suppose we say this every 5 or 10 years, it seems, that the world is in a crazy place. But it certainly, as you point to, you know, Brexit, Trump, there's certainly the right wing now seem to be dominating the debate. Perhaps not so much in this country at the moment, but where do you see the sort of left in South Africa now in terms of socioeconomic transformation or the lack of it, and where do you think we are going politically as a country in the sort of opening early years of our democracy? Are we just sort of experiencing normal chaotic birth pains of a democratic system, or?
Look, I prefer to talk about democratization rather than just democracy, because I think it's an ongoing process. this notion of consolidation of democracy that you find in some of the mainstream political studies literature for me makes no sense. It's a democracy is supposed to be a permanent state of contestation. So it's supposed to be for me, it's never completely won, but it's also not completely lost. You know, so and in South Africa, we're basically in the process of trying to democratize ourselves. We're very much, all of us, black and white, still very much stuck in apartheid thinking, racialized thinking, gendered thinking, thinking about sexuality, about able-bodiedness and so forth, all differences. If you think about it, apartheid was all about problematizing difference. And now we're saying, also in light of the social contract that we have with one another in the form of our constitution, we're actually saying difference is not a problem, it's actually a strength. And whatever differences we may have, we all share in humanity and human dignity. And if you think about that problematization of difference, that's very much, of course, what we're seeing in the right wing, the global far-right politics that's sort of rising, you know, which is, again, this overemphasis on others, you know, who are different to us, you know, and how they endanger threat. Us. Yes, that whole discourse, which is also how apartheid was to a large extent also justified over the years. You know, we're a tiny minority, we need this policy to keep ourselves safe. So that discourse of fear, which is used in this far-right racial populism and also populism that uses gender and sexuality in particular kinds of ways. You know, so South Africa, you know, one, we do suffer from a bit of exceptionalism, so I don't want to sound like an exceptionalist. But I do think that South Africa, in a sense, everything that's happening here at micro level, one could say, is in a sense was sort of we've been a bit of a front runner of what's been happening globally, and obviously we also are influenced by what's happening globally. Mm. Just in terms of the political and economic position that we're in, ultimately, and that's what I actually address in my first book. I look at that transition period specifically, and I dig into the kinds of compromises that were made in the early 1990s in the negotiations. And if you look at the ANC's shift towards the neoliberal economic position, which was ultimately then confirmed, well, it started already with the RDP white paper. People think of the Reconstruction and Development Program
as a radical program.
Yeah, but its original version, well, it wasn't radical, it was sort of more welfarist. Mm. So the original version was that kind of welfarist version that was much more suitable for the conditions in South Africa. The eventual version, as in the white paper, and then if you look at GEAR, when you speak to ANC people also, they always say, well, you know, GEAR builds on the RDP white paper, and it's true, actually. So you see that neoliberal shift already in the RDP white paper. Mm. And basically, so there you have liberalization, deregulation, and so forth. We've had massive capital flight enabled by these policies. I did a study on the clothing industry that's been basically decimated because of liberalization and so forth and so on. So and of course that's been the biggest our biggest problem, that we've actually adopted an economic policy that's not suitable
really suit us
for our conditions, with 37% unemployment if you look at the expanded definition.
Yeah.
And on the table in the beginning of the 1990s, you had either growth through redistribution or redistribution through growth. And we decided to opt for the second option, which is the growth through redistribution through growth. So that means that you need to grow before you're going to redistribute. And the fact of the matter is, so if you've got we've had an investment strike by our capitalist class since forever. We're
talking simply internal investment now,
internal,
not even foreign direct.
I'm not even talking about foreign investment. Yes. Internal investment
sitting on bundles
that are
of cash.
way lower at than what it should be, and the reason for that is of course they would say, oh, well, it's political instability and unpredictableness and so on. Well, Angola a few years ago had the highest economic growth on the African continent. Mm. And I can't think of many other countries as unstable and unpredictable as Angola, but capitalists were piling in there. Mm. So that excuse for me doesn't hold water. And so we are sitting with a kind of a problem around the social consensus about how do we solve our problems. And we're not, you know, people that have been speaking about an economic CODESA of some sort. I've actually recently said on a radio program that we should be seriously looking at that.
Yeah.
We need to arrive at some kind of social consensus about how do we shift the unemployment problem, which is the biggest problem standing in the way of the betterment of everybody's lives.
Mm.
27 million people under the breadline, still more than 20 years into democracy.
Yes.
You know, people then lose their hope. And they lose their investment in democracy as a system. And they start to think, well, maybe other systems will be better. We need some strong man to come and sort out these white capitalists.
Mm.
But the fact of the matter is, and that's when people actually become partial and become influenced by these global discourses as well, where you do see a rise of the strongman politics. So it is very detrimental, definitely, to South Africa, also at this sensitive moment in our democratization process, that that global politics also going in this particular
shifting against this
direction.
Yeah.
And then you have, to compound matters, then you have organizations like Solidaritas and AfriForum that are also dispensing a terrible reactionary politics, which is strengthening a very offensive and arrogant form of whiteness, and also particularly of a heteropatriarchal whiteness, you know. So you
throw a bit of land into that, and then you've got a real nice cocktail.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly the problem, because you want white people who are by and large well off. I think the figure of white people living under the breadline is something like 45,000.
Some recent statistics now from the Human Rights Commission, I think. I mean, it was really shocking in terms of, as you say, the imbalance in terms of who's...
So I'm not saying that white people should be under the breadline either, you know, so, but it's more...
Just put it in a context.
Yeah, so we've got incredible affluence among white people. And so at this point in time, you also want white people stepping up and saying, what can we do to solve the problems of our country, particularly in terms of socioeconomic inequality. And when you've got parties like organizations like Solidaritas and AfriForum adopting this discourse of racial populism, of whiteness and so forth, it's
coupled
not helping.
With that kind of arrogance, as you say. It's
And then you've got on the EFF, which I argue is a kind of a proto-fascist phenomenon as well, which is also using a discourse of racial populism, but this time now black against white. And you've got quite a combustible situation, I have to say.
Given this sort of chaotic reality, what would you like to see then, or what do you think can push our... Because I think that... you know, whatever you have to say about, or wherever you stand on state capture or white monopoly capital, it seems that the Jacob Zuma presidency has really put the brakes on our development on so many levels, be it social or economic or just racial. How do we kind of get out of this, the doldrums we're in now?
Mm. Well, but firstly, by citizens accepting that we're all in it together, and we all have to jump in to make it better wherever we are. I do think a lot of people are already doing that. I think there is already a lot of incredible work happening. If you look at the civil society sector, you're looking at some business people becoming more active, more outspoken in support of democracy and against corruption and so forth. But ultimately, we need to reactivate our social contract, which is our constitution. We have to recenter it in our social and political and economic life, and come together and actually, in a sense, reassert and recommit ourselves to those values. But also understanding that those values don't immediately become actualized just because they've been written down on paper. So that we all have to jump in to make it happen wherever we are. And I'm cautiously optimistic by the completely different tone that's been adopted by Cyril Ramaphosa, I have to say. I think that he's, you know, the Tumamina idea, the idea of wherever you are,
get involved,
step up and do what you can where you are. You know, and white people, and I do a lot of sort of talks where white people come to me afterwards, what can we do? You know, like you can, wherever you are, you do already have some form of power, some capital, et cetera, that you can use in various ways. You know, it starts also just with our relationships with one another.
Simple behavior.
Yes. So it starts with that, but also thinking beyond that. You know, seeing, you know, can you help, you know, somebody go to university, you know, that, you know, et cetera, you know, how can you make education opportunities available, you know, with your resources? How can you get involved in other kinds of civil organizing wherever you are living and so forth? So I like that idea a lot, but I think, of course, you know, the ANC being in incredible turmoil, that's obviously making things much harder. And the reason, of course, why corruption and the kind of entitlement that you see that runs with it, that discourse of entitlement, is in part also due to neoliberalism, the neoliberal economic policy that we've adopted. Because if we had more efficient redistribution over the past 20-odd years, I don't think that corruption would have taken hold to the extent that it has. Because ultimately what you have is a situation of people have not been... They're seeing incredible wealth around them. So it's that question of relative deprivation. People have not... And they feel, I've not really benefited. And the only... And there's no job to be had. So how am I going to benefit? And that immediately opens the opportunity for corruption. So we need to be thinking much harder how we can make the state again also work, you know, for everybody. Mm. It's a massive kind of overhaul that one is thinking of.
Yeah.
And I mentioned earlier the question of an economic Odessa. Maybe that's exactly the kind of event that you need
to galvanize.
Yeah. You know, And do it in the South African, in that fantastic South African tradition where people, you know, the Freedom Charter was written with submissions from people from all over the country,
pieces
of paper being handed in. If you look at the petitions handed over by the women in the that massive march, 1955 march, to the union buildings in Pretoria, again,
yeah,
wads and wads of paper from all over the country being gathered. So you need that kind of level of consultation, which we also had with the Constitution. You know, people, it was an incredible consultation process that led to the Constitution. So we need a renewal and a recommitment at a national scale and drawing people in. So that's what I'm hoping for. And I do think if, depending on next year's election, if Cyril Ramaphosa does well, that will strengthen his hand in the ANC itself, and that might be good for the organisation also, as not the only leading organisation, but obviously a very important organisation.
Christy, thanks very much for your time this afternoon.
Thanks. Very good to talk to you, Nicholas.
Thanks a lot for listening. I hope you enjoyed that pretty intense discussion at times. Well, it raised some important issues, I think, around where we are as a country, as a nation, as a democracy, and certainly set out the fragile state of our current socioeconomic and political situation. I mean, that figure of 27 million people living below the breadline came as a shock to me, and I consider myself fairly informed. And that is a kind of threat to any political system or project. But as Christy says, you know, we're all in the same boat. And I do agree that the white population in South Africa do need to recognize the role they can play and become more proactive or active in promoting a meaningful transformation of our social and economic landscape. Please subscribe in Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a rating or comment. The ratings are important for the podcast to reach a wider audience. Voices from SA is also available on Spotify, Deezer, Radio Public, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.